The kids on Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
Halloweenies, a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
From the Consequence Podcast Network, the minds behind The Losers Club, comes a new podcast in fantasy terror.
Nancy, there's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Halloweenies, a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello to all of you pod people out there. I'm your host, Leo Phillips, and welcome to another edition of This Must Be the Gig. It's a little podcast about all your things live music and performance. So what we try and do each and every week is bring you fascinating conversations from the beating heart of the live music and performance scenes. And the way that we do that is chat to musicians, festival founders, choreographers, comedians, actors, really anyone obsessed with performance in the way that we are. And we find out what their first gig was, what their first performance was, their first album they ever bought on CD or vinyl or cassette, whatever mode they choose. Before we dig into this week's fantastic interview, let's check in with our constant companion here at TMBTG Studios, Engineer Adam. Hello!
Hey, hi, hello.
How's it going?
It's going real well. How are you?
I am doing well. I'm excited once again to dig into our favorite feature. Before we get into the interview as well, let's just go through the TMBTG Studios live show of the week, where we pick and highlight one of the most heart-thumping events we could find out there, and we just share it with people.
Amazing. And this week's live show of the week, we have a primetime stop on the Triumphant Return Tour from French indie masterminds Stereolab, who we love here at the show. They're going to be at the Moda Center in Portland on Sunday, October 13th. We were lucky enough to see Stereolab here at the Pitchfork Music Festival over the summer here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And even though it was a shortened set because of some rain, it was, I think, maybe my favorite performance of the summer. Definitely up there anyway. And opening for this stop at the Moda Center is the psych rock outfit Wand, who happened to include a former bandmate of this very person.
Oh, yeah.
The drummer for a band I was in high school and college, Evan Burrows. So go out there and see my pal Evan and also Stereolab. What a great little connection that is there, huh?
If you want to get in on all of the excitement of that show and any other, you can head over to StubHub via cosradio.lv/StubHub and find the best selection of tickets to the hottest shows. That's cosradio.lv/StubHub. Our guest today is Natasha Khan, aka Bat for Lashes, one of the most passionate and expressive writers out there. The London-born art pop artist went gold in the UK with her debut record Fur and Gold after three more slabs of equally cinematic beauty. Natasha's most recent record is the slick and sublime and super cheeky Lost Girls, an album indebted to the bliss of Bananarama and Cyndi Lauper and the grand scope of composer John Williams. So this week, Natasha calls in to discuss the complications of character-driven songwriting. We also talk about her experiences teaching meditation to newly released prisoners, opening for Radiohead and opening for Coldplay, and both of our Father's Days of Squash Glory. So let us not be delayed. Listen to our chat, then get listening. This is us. Enjoy!
LA is definitely a strange, it's a very unique, strange sort of terrain compared to sort of like European cities or New York or something. I feel like LA is a whole new thing you have to learn how to navigate, and it's so sprawling and so kind of rootless in a lot of ways. But I agree, I think after a few years you kind of have your you understand how the city works better, and you have your friends and your community, hopefully, and you've gotten used to all the driving and the burning heat.
So many different things apart from just the environment that is different. Just literally, there's just the feel of the air and how people look and how people talk. But it's also like I find the intention behind some people. I've struggled a little with that familiarity because we all grow up with American movies and pop culture when we're younger. But when you're actually living here and you understand how gigantic America is and how diverse it is, I feel like there's a lot of navigating that has to happen internally, more so than, you know, getting used to the weather and things like that. I don't know. It's just, it is a strange thing, but within your identity, obviously, of who you are, how do you attach to a place and try and acclimate very quickly? Or do you still feel like you're very much, you know, your heart is very much with your family still?
I think I'm quite a adaptable sort of person, especially being a musician and a creative person. I think I really love to live in different countries and absorb the culture and the landscape and find like the differences quite fruitful and creative. So obviously my heart is with my family and in England, but my family, like my dad lives in America, my mum's in Belgium, my cousins and aunties are in France, my boyfriend's from Australia. My life is very global and anyway. So I think wherever I go, I find something to connect with. I find lovely people and I try to find people with a similar sense of humour because I think that's really important. People that you can laugh with and dance with anywhere will make you feel at home. Just finding like my tribe of people wherever I go. And then I sort of like, I love that an hour and a half down the road, there's a desert or there's huge trees or, you know, compared to England, it's really wild and beautiful and epic, you know, the landscapes that you can be in so quickly here.
And that can, I'm sure, feed into the creativity. And I loved what you said now about being a creative person. There's a lot of what you do that is in tune with absorbing other people's culture. You know, you do it whether it's subconsciously or not. You're touring and you have been touring for so many years and you get to be exposed to just so many different types of people. So has that been something for you as an artist that's been incredibly rewarding in this journey? Because there's so many different facets of what you do. But has that element of it been quite transformative for you?
I don't know if it was a transformation. I think it's something I've just continued from childhood because coming from my dad, who's from Pakistan, and my mum's from England, and my dad is an international squash, you know, coach of like a number one world champion.
Oh my gosh.
who was my cousin. So we always had international kids coming to stay in our house. Kids from America, Canada, Pakistan, you know, Europe, and he was always training them and they would live with us. And then he was touring the world all throughout my childhood. And I think before I was one, I'd been to almost every country in the world with my mum going on tour and stuff. So I think it's just very natural to me to be, I myself am a combination of cultures and races, and it just makes sense for me to feel like the global community of my family. Like I don't feel, I feel that I'm part of a world culture. You know, I'm not someone that's, I do have my heritage and my kind of love of England is very deep, but and that is my home, but I never feel out of place in another country or another culture, because I think it seems so normal to me to just to be open-minded and really enjoy differences.
I love that he played squash. I think for anybody listening to the show, if they don't know what squash is, my dad played squash as well, like every single Sunday.
Very 80s.
Literally, when I was growing up in the 80s, I used to go and sit and watch him play this really bizarre sport.
I would say it's a very fast-paced racket sport.
There you go.
between two competitors.
Oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. And like the ball just goes around. But when we saw them play, they'd have a glass court with one opaque wall, and you can, you know, it's a bit like an amphitheatre sort of thing, watching like you know, lions fight the Christians or something, because it was very like theatrical.
It's very gladiator, because you're right. I think I missed the biggest part of it. It's so fast, because you basically I think with tennis there is that thing with pacing, is that how you get the ball to your opponent definitely depends on your talent and skill. But in squash, if your talent and skill is like really strong and you're going full force at the wall is essentially the opponent. You know, there's like a third
that's
player.
That's a good way of putting it.
You know?
Yeah, that's a really good way.
I didn't think I was
going
to wake up today and have a analyze squash.
Discussion about squash.
So what did you guys chat about? Squash. You know, that's it.
I think it was a really sweet thing, though, as a kid to see my dad, like, coaching younger children. And you were saying, like, what did I do when I came here to... you know, adapt to LA. I actually worked as a teacher for 10 weeks as like a visiting artist teacher kids who had dropped out of school, and it's a continuation school. And then I taught meditation to some prisoners who had come out of prison and were adapting to the workforce and stuff. So I think a part of me is, and I also trained as a nursery school teacher before I did music. So part of me, I think, has taken that thing from my dad of like nurturing younger people and wanting to direct them and help them. But also his confidence and focus and passion and determination. I think, you know, you need a lot of that to tour the world, whether you're doing music or squash or whatever you're doing.
Absolutely.
It's a very kind of focused sort of athletic thing to do.
Yeah, and disciplined, as you said, and there's so much you can relate to in terms of having a student that you're teaching, especially somebody from a background who's within the rehabilitation journey of coming from prison.
Mm-hmm.
You also there's so much discovery in that, and I feel like in a musician's life there's a lot of inner discovery that's needed to happen, but also just in general your job is to observe really and kind of teach everybody else what you've learned in the process. I suppose
I like to do stuff like that. I think it's really good for me and good for them.
Yeah,
you know, like it's
course.
A two-way street, because being a creative person or a musician can be quite isolating sometimes, and you're in the writing process, or like you say, observing or channeling ideas takes a lot of quiet time and reflection and alone time to sort of craft something and write music and sing and be in this world. And I think LA of all cities can be quite lonely and isolating too, so like those two things together, I was like, I need to get out.
I need to get the hell out
and do something and contribute, you know, because I needed some routine or a connection to like my community around me, which is a very heavily Hispanic Mexican community. And I just wanted to sort of delve into that more and be like, I'm not just going to turn up as an artist and just waft around with my arty friends. Like, I'm a citizen of this city, and I want to you know, see what's really happening in the real world here.
Yeah, and I think that's a much better and more positive approach in terms of just your own growth. I don't know if, I think you mentioned the word isolation. I think many creatives, regardless of whether you're public facing and on stage or not, I think that kind of isolated creativity, sometimes people do that so that they can really focus on themselves and focus on the art. But it unfortunately, by doing that, it does shut you off to the things around you. And I think, how can you really learn about a place if you don't know about the people that live there? It's kind of, you know, logically that makes sense, but I know a lot of people are kind of afraid. They either feel like it's not inclusive enough or they don't fit in, which is the exact point at which you should go out there and do something. But it does take guts. I think it definitely takes, you know, you've got to be very vulnerable and selfless and to give your time like that.
Yeah, and it's scary to come into in a room full of giant, you know, Mexican and black prisoners, you know, like scary big guys that have been in gangs and done probably done crazy stuff, but they were all very welcoming and respectful and really sweet to me and really kind. And it was very intimidating, but I was just like, I'm just going to throw myself in. And the kids as well here, you know, like the teenagers anywhere in the world are a difficult audience. Sometimes they just didn't want to do anything, and other times they were really inspired, but that's just life. Like, it's not in my work that I do, everyone's very positive, and I get musicians to come and work with me, and everyone's like, yeah, let's do this. And I just interact with people, but it's easy, you know. But working at the school, it was like very emotional sometimes, very difficult, but also like wonderful. But yeah, I agree. I think it's good to put yourself in a scary place when you've been doing something for so long that you know you can do. I mean, it's still scary to me to put out an album and to try and write an album, and it's a challenge.
Yes.
But yeah, you have to, like, I think it's good to stay inexperienced at some things and try new things, definitely.
Yeah, I just don't know. It's kind of like seeing a visual chart of a line going in a straight, you know what I mean? A straight line without any bumps and breaks or crumbles. I just don't know how interesting that visual looks. And obviously in hindsight, when you go through shit and you're like, oh, this feels awful. I can't get out of it. It's too deep. I'm in the gunk. I'm in that goo. And then you come out of it and then you think, you know, thank God for that, because you're living, at least you're living. And I think that that kind of perspective is obviously incredibly powerful. But when you're in it, you're like, no, I don't want this. Well, at least I am. It's just painful. But I definitely think, you know, putting yourself outside of your comfort zone and doing something is definitely, you learn valuable lessons that I don't know. How else you could really do it. I suppose, as you said earlier, as a touring artist, you get to learn that too. Boundaries, cultures, your own work ethic. I can imagine you've learned a lot about that too. But so so you mentioned making this album, or making an album in general. What were the, I don't want to say challenges because I find it's kind of a boxy word, but what were the things that you found hadn't come up before?
To be honest, it sounds like a weird answer, but I honestly didn't find this album challenging, which is, I think, why it's one of my better albums. And the reason for that was that I think because I was developing this album with Charles Scott, who was my kind of co-producer, co-helper on this record, but I had a very strong vision kind of early on for the script of this album, like if it was to be a film, what that would be. So I had this narrative, and I was living here, and I moved, and I think I was so full of so much stimulus and inspiration, and, you know, so many different impressions that I'd gathered from being here and not in England. I was really full up with a lot of, like, love and ideas and excitement and romance about what the sound of this film might be, the soundtrack to this, like, amazing, like 80s themes, like really cool, dark, sexy film I wanted to make. And then when I went to make the music, it was just there. And I think also being on a major record label, which I was before, so I just finished a 10-year deal with EMI Warner. I think the way that you, like, usually create an album when everyone else is involved is that they're like, okay, so we've only got this much budget, so you have to go in the studio for 2 to 3 weeks, get it done then, and then the whole thing should be done really in 6 weeks. That would have been a challenge for me if I'd done it that way this time, but I did it over a year and a half, and very secretly, and just in my own time, when me and Charles had like a spare day, we'd just get together and secretly do this stuff. I didn't really tell anyone I was doing it. And I think that relieved all the pressure of anyone even knowing that I was making an album, or judging it, or having questions. I just did it because I was enjoying myself. And that was really liberating and felt very freeing. And I think to me, the album sounds very, like, full of liberation and excitement, which is how it felt, really.
It really does. I've listened to it in so many different places, you know, at home, on the road, walking, a lot of walking and listening to it, and it's just it definitely has that energy and that feeling of it's much more, the pacing is much more open than your music before, but it's still very familiar. Yeah. So you've kept so much of your spirit that you've had on your previous albums, but it definitely feels very light. Some songs, of course, in terms of the lyrical content, depending on how you perceive them, are really, of course, much heavier and much darker. But the but everything about the sound is incredibly, it's open. And that could mean, that could mean a lot. But you've also written so expertly in kind of alter ego or character before, and especially now with this kind of film idea. Did you inhabit that character in order to develop the music? Or does the process of writing the music result in having that character? Which one is first?
I think it's a combination. The first song I wrote was Kids in the Dark, and I wasn't in character for that, because I was just feeling the romance of LA and like just thinking about being in love and stuff like that. And then as the album developed, I guess like songs like The Hunger or Vampires or Jasmine would definitely be coming more from the script idea, and with sort of Nikki as the protagonist. But The Hunger, for example, was me being Nikki and imagining all the girls coming to get me and what we would do together. But then Jasmine is like one of the lost girls, so that's her story. The album is a real combination of all of those things. And the same with Pearl and Two Sons, like she featured here and there, and she was definitely someone I went to for sometimes the lyrical inspiration or just for a feeling. But the last album, The Bride, I was kind of, that whole album I wrote out every song as like chapters of a novel before I even wrote the song, because I knew that it was, I was the bride for all of those songs. Like that last album was probably my strongest kind of character concept record. So I've done it both ways, all different ways, like you say, but I think it's, for me, it's just really nice to have, to create my own mythology and characters and narrative and archetypes and stories. I think myths are extremely powerful. And when we say myths, we think a lot of like Greek mythology or old religious stories or mysticism. But myths, I think, is still very like relevant in today's society. Like the myths we tell ourselves as a society, the stories we create, the narratives we create. And they can be very fearful and damaging, or they can be very positive and healing. So I just want to be contributing to the healing myths that connect us all, that heal our wounds as a society, that help us go to the dark places, like you said, places we don't want to really sit in, but that create a lot more beauty and like nuance and there's a lot more fruit in those dark places, I think, than just a straight line that you on the graph that's just like this, perfect thing, which doesn't exist.
Well, the stories that we hear from our parents, our grandparents, friends, people that we meet working, strangers, those stories are so important. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the human, it's like our human right to pass those down.
Yeah.
And obviously I love that there's a song called Vampire, that's such a huge part of society. We're fascinated by those fantasy characters, and they conjure a visual element straight away, which I find so much of your music does. You can listen to it, and then you can have your mind work in pictures just instantly.
And
you mentioned The Bride, and I was just thinking now, that is so, I totally, one of the best festivals, End of the Road Festival, which I covered a few years ago, I saw you perform that, it was during that album, and mm-hmm. When was that? 2016, I think it was.
16.
Yeah,
it must have been. Mm-hmm.
And there was this live proposal. Really... Do you remember?
Yeah. Well, that was my really good friend who proposed to each other. They've since been married, and I went there with him.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, it was very romantic and sweet, and it was kind of a good antidote to this sad story. that there was some romance at the end of that show.
I know. And the crowd, it was raining that whole weekend. It was raining, but it was never cold. It was just like, okay, we're going to just, our bodies are just going to be damp and soaked, which made it all the more dramatic, because it was like you were wearing this long white dress and reaching out to the crowd and everybody was reaching back at you. And it was one of those really, really emphatic moments of just, I remember looking around at some of the people that I was there with and just thinking, wow, we might not ever see something like this. You know, who gets to see a live proposal on stage at a festival in the middle of the UK? You know, it's not something that happens often.
No, it was really special. It was very special. And like you say, that, you know, music to me is about like ritual and community, and especially the live shows, things like that, where people love to go to a wedding or they love to be witness to some sort of heightened moment. And we don't all go to church anymore or have Sunday places, community centres and things where everyone hangs out and goes for a dance on a Friday night. I would love to have that, more of that. I would give anything to have a Friday night dance that me and all my friends go to every week and play cards and drink. And it's like, I think people are starving for that. They're quite hungry. And so when moments like that happen where you're all gathered together for a purpose, and then on top of that, people declare their undying love to each other. It's like, yeah, I want more of that. Like,
come on, great. Anybody
that's
else?
Yeah.
Anybody else want to get married today? Just push two random sods onto stage, both of them looking confused, like, okay, I guess this is happening.
Getting swept up in the moment.
Pause the podcast.
Pause the podcast.
Are you looking at a calendar full of great events but struggling to find tickets? StubHub's gotcha. Whatever your favorite band, team, or venue, StubHub is here to save the day with the best tickets for any budget.
Whether you're looking for a seat at a Broadway show, tickets to the summer's big arena tour, or a night of cheering on your hometown team, StubHub has the seats you're looking for at the price you want to pay.
Head to cosradio.lv/StubHub or their user-friendly app to find tickets that are 100% guaranteed by FanProtect. StubHub's never sold out, with the most shows, the most tickets, and the most fans.
So, head on over to cosradio.lv/StubHub, or the StubHub app. The best tickets to the best experiences in music, sports, and theater.
That's cosradio.lv/StubHub.
And I love what you said, that music is a ritual, because there is that thing that you can hold on to, especially with storytelling linked to that. We so badly want that to see people happy and to see people fall in love. And yes, there's the romanticism that's been like, you know, it's hypervent. It's just gone crazy on TV, although I love that when it's taken to the extreme. Yeah. There is so much in that people try to recreate within their own lives, whether it's, you know, in relationships or working environment. There's so much that people want out of that, you know, that feeling of community and connection. So do you, in terms of just live performance, is that something, do you enjoy that side of what you do and part of the journey of you as an artist? Do you enjoy performing live?
I do. I think I'm naturally like a much more homebody person, and I'm not like the most extrovert person. I am friendly and outgoing, but I wouldn't say I'm one of those people that loves playing live and I can't wait to get on stage. It's quite a big effort for me to pluck up the energy and the courage to do that. But once I'm on stage, I really enjoy being the conduit of some energy. That's how I feel about it, is you're kind of like the head priestess of something. It's sort of my job and my responsibility to take care of the audience and to channel something very like high energy and beautiful and something that's coming through me. onto them and through them and with them, so that everybody can experience that kind of religious feeling of togetherness and being connected into like the source energy, which is like enlivening and full of love, and you know, and it's just bright and exciting and beautiful and dark and all the things. Because I think that what everyone's looking for, like you say, is a connection to each other, but to see, like you said, you know, we want to see people in love, or we want to see beautiful things or things that elevate us. And I think that's especially in this world where everyone's on their phone all the time and so much stimulation, so much content, we have less and less time and less places to go to reflect and sit with ourselves and to find that connection just on our own. So like you say, we look to romantic films, we look to music shows, we look to drugs and parties or exciting work or whatever it is to connect you to that, you know, that force, which is great. But I think for me, going back to stories, it's the story you tell yourself. Like, what story do you tell yourself about your connection to those things, and when do you have time to sit and and feel that joy just with no other stimulation, with through nothing else? So when I'm on tour, before I go out and do a show, I will meditate and do yoga and sit in my room, and I just center myself and I get myself connected to that place, so that when I go out on stage, I know that hopefully I'm going to channel some of that stuff, and then it will provide like a optimum experience for everybody. But that's kind of taking it as like a spiritual service rather than being, you know, a musician. And it can be quite hard to do that for months on end.
But because
I don't, you know, I'm not with my family or with my loved ones or my dog, or I want to, you know, I'd love to be home cooking and things like that. But my feeling is that if I do it, I have to do it really well. And I can't just go out like half-assed and be like, hey, woohoo, you know, like, it's really important to me. Although maybe with this new album, there's more sort of, you know, it's more uplifting and fun, so I could just more dance cheeky. Around and be more silly.
I definitely felt that but I also think that having that ritual before you perform is of course grounding, but it's also something then that you can use to put you into that mindset of, right, this is what I'm going to put my mind and heart and body into, as opposed to I'm just not sure. I'm not a performer. I'm on the other side of it, but I'm just not sure how you would go into anything if you don't do some sort of preparation. You know, it's such a grueling, physically, it's also such a grueling thing, which I think a lot of people don't, they think if you don't move around on stage that you're not exerting energy, which doesn't make sense because there's so much.
And I move around a lot. And it's really important to look after your voice, like your body is your instrument. So, you know, like some people will get, you know, like guitarists can get really drunk the night before. They might not play that great, but their hands aren't damaged, so they can play. But if I got really drunk the night before, my voice sounds bad, you know, like I can't sustain that for weeks on end. So it's almost like it's very disciplined. I have to be very healthy and try and get a good night's sleep on a bus and loads of people snoring. Like, you know, people coming in and out and lights going on and off and being moved around all night. You know, there's a lot of, it's a challenge to stay well and healthy on the road, because it's basically full of things that are very difficult to kind of overcome. But I have a lot of things in place where I warm up and warm down my voice and try and eat, like not eat dairy, just because that creates loads of mucus on your vocal cords. And I try and stay fit so I can jump around and not get tired and out of breath when I'm singing as well. And then there's all, you know, the nerves and the anxiety, like the emotional stuff that comes with moving all the time. And So yeah, but then it's equally can be so fun, and like you say, just seeing all these amazing cities, seeing all the fans who are so sweet, and feeling that energy and love back off of the audience is gives me that communal experience that I, you know, that I miss.
Right.
And it's really, that's really sweet, and it's a very like joyful thing to have done a really great show,
right,
to come off stage. Yeah,
I definitely think that balances it out, because there's that huge duality that I think performers, whether you're on screen or on stage, you're going onto a stage, somebody is watching you, but there's that huge energy exchange of people screaming and so much going on. You can feel that vibrating, that frequency, and then you suddenly alone in the bus, on the tour bus, you know, with the curtains kind of half drawn, lights going on and off, a bumpy road, and then it's quiet, and then you have that duality kind of on repeat, on loop. But so do you have any limitations in terms of what you won't do on tour? Like, is there anything that you just, after doing this for so long, you've just realized, you know, other than obviously taking care of yourself and not going out and getting totally sloshed, but is there any is there anything that you won't do because you know that it would be harmful towards your performance and or just your mental well-being?
Like, sometimes you have to do a lot of interviews or promotion in the day.
Yes.
But I have to have like a few hours before to not be, because you're giving out so much anyway. And I remember sometimes just having to talk like in interviews for hours, and then I've got to go and do like an hour and a half of singing. And it's just like, what do you think my vocal cord, like, you know, we're just, you know, it's just like, it's so hard to explain to people. People don't realize, they don't think of that. So I try to just make sure that I get like enough time. But I think the main thing I don't do anymore is, when I started, I had a great team, but there's a lot of people sometimes on the road that have like drink or drug problems and would be drinking all day, you know, before they set up the stage, and then mistakes get made. And when you're a new artist, you need people, and you can be quite naive, or just, you think, oh, I should just put up with this, like, these people with terrible like addictions and behavior. And now I just would not put up with that because I have done it for so long. But I think that was a really difficult transition for me to respect myself enough and to feel confident enough to say, look, this doesn't work for me to have toxic, you know, like partying and all this crazy behavior from my crew that, you know, that I need to pay to be professional. And when it reflects badly on the show because things don't work, or, you know, someone's in a bad mood and snaps at, you know, all of that stuff that I think can be very prevalent, I think I just won't accept that. So people that are on my crew are like, my team now are incredibly professional and very like loving and protective and sort of have like great integrity, those people. You know, I love my team, and they consist of men and women. Like, I love a nice mixture of girls and boys. I think it's really cool. And everyone's very, very respectful. So when they're working, and we keep it like a nice environment for everyone to be in, because you're kind of like family living together. And if you're in a family with someone with, you know, who's an alcoholic, who's just like not pulling their weight, I think you'd, out of love, you'd say something. So that's kind of what, the way I look at it is, like, we all need to look out for each other and be kind. And it doesn't mean that you don't have fun and people don't, you know, we drink and have fun and do stuff, but it's just to make sure that we're all aware that that we're doing the best job we can for the show.
And knowing what your limitations are in terms of just accepting, you know, professional, that level of professionalism, and how if something does go wrong, people often just look at the artist. They forget that there's an entire crew around that could have affected that, you know? So there's also that out of sight, out of mind thing with how the industry actually works. So that's an amazing lesson, I think, terrible to go through, but an amazing thing for you to learn, you know, which you can only do after you've toured for so long. I mean, also just thinking of who you've toured with, I know very early in your catalogue, you opened some shows for Radiohead, and you later toured with Coldplay, I think it was, in South America. I was reading somewhere. Yeah. It was South America. Was that? Yes, I'm right.
It was South America, and Depeche Mode in America. Yeah, we've done some big tours with huge bands, which is really fun.
But they're also like really culty. Cool. Yeah, they're culty bands too. So there's like levels and notches that a band can make, and I feel like especially with your work, you have such loyal fans. But look, just saying Radiohead, Coldplay, it's almost an entire genre of music, Depeche Mode as well. What was it like to face some of those crowds? How different was it for you to go in there knowing that you were in that kind of history-making experience?
They've been some of my best memories, especially because when we supported Radiohead, it was for the In Rainbows tour.
Oh, and my God.
That was one of my favourite albums ever. And it was beautiful and just sort of going around all the amphitheatres in Europe. We went to Nantes and I'm trying to think. Yeah, that one was like a really old gladiator sort of amphitheatre, you know, like ancient rocks and stones and so all of the venues we were going to were incredible, and then we'd get to play to everyone, which was fun. And like sometimes people discover who you are through that, and that's great. And other times people aren't that interested. You know, it's quite a tough crowd, but we'd try and win them over, and they like. But the best bit was after we finished our show, all of us we'd go and eat some food, and they made really lovely catered sort of healthy food. And then as a band, we'd all run out every night and be like, let's go and watch the show. And we watched that full show every night for like 3 weeks and cried pretty much every night. Like it was just a beautiful thing to witness and see, and such an amazing band performing. And then with Coldplay, they were massive audiences, like maybe, I can't remember, like 60,000 or 100,000, I don't know, but just huge stadiums in South America. And the South Americans are so sweet, and a lot of Bat for Lashes fans came up to the front and they were like, Natasha, Natasha. And we were so like bowled over that they even knew who we were. But so cute and like really excited. And then we'd play some shows and I think we did pretty well. Like people, you know, to come out to a huge stadium like that. There were, you know, some people that stayed and listened to us. And again, to watch Coldplay or Depeche Mode, like to watch these bands do their thing, and for everyone to be holding up lighters, like an ocean of lighters and glow sticks and people singing. And it's like, it makes you cry. It's like so powerful.
It's really,
really, really amazing.
Yeah, especially because those bands they've got so, especially that In Rainbows tour, I remember I saw that as well. Just, it was like on the cusp between their last tour and then them starting In Rainbows tour. And I can't remember where, it was probably in Belgium somewhere at one of the festivals. Yes, Rock Werchter.
Yeah.
And I just remember how, when people cry seeing those shows, it's like when people cry watching Sigur Rós. It's a deep, it's like a howl. I feel like it's something from somewhere else. And especially a band like Radiohead, who's been, it's not only that they're so well known, it's that their music has just kind of stood the test of trends and time and, you know, just the ideology behind some of the songs. So did you connect to, you know, the artists as well? How much of your time was spent actually building those relationships? Like, could you talk to them about their craft and ask questions? Like how comfy are you with doing that?
Yeah, we spent lots of time together, and I, you know, have made friends with Tom York, you know, and all of the guys in that band are lovely. And then Chris Martin was really nice and supportive and sweet. If I ever see them, they're always very kind to me. And we had some deep chats about songwriting and music. And I asked Tom York his opinion about whether I should do this commercial and like, what do you think about commerce versus like artistry and creativity? And lots of lovely conversations, and we spent New Year's Eve together, I think like 4 years ago, you know, things like that. So it's nice as the friendship's built, and I haven't seen any of them for a while, but, you know, there's always like good energy there. And you end up eating dinner together or chatting, and it's just nice because you feel like they've taken you under their wing or acknowledged you in some way, and it's really nice to chat and for them to talk, you know, to ask you things too.
Do you remember something that they asked you that you kind of were a bit taken aback from? Was there anything that you guys chatted about at the time that you felt like, oh, this is an interesting take on something, you know? Because obviously all those interactions are so, they're so quick, you know, you go through this tour and then you're on to the next. So was there anything about that those interactions that really stood out to you?
You know, like if Chris Martin was saying, like, what do you think of this song? Or like, what do you think of, you know, what do I think of what he's doing? And I thought that was so funny that I would be asked that. But obviously that's cool because, you know, he respects what I do. And when you've been established for a while, new bands are interesting. You know, it's a give and take process of, that, you know, we can kind of inspire each other or we have different viewpoints. But I always, you know, I felt humbled and was like, that's cool that I'm, you know, that I'm, my opinion's important, and as a songwriter and things like that. So that's nice.
Absolutely. And just being respected and having that kind of relationship build on that, because it's kind of shitty when you get stuck on tour if you are on a big label with people that you aren't inspired by, or, you know, you don't really form that close relationship with. I'm sure you just get by and you just deal with it. But
yeah,
sometimes when you do have those experiences that can really affect the way that you think about the work you make. I can only imagine that's really helpful for you just to enjoy your time as well, because you want to have fun.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
You want it to be interesting. But is there? Do you remember the first time you ever performed?
So my first performance, I remember being, I think I was like 17 or 18, and I performed at I can't even remember what it was. It was just some small, almost like in a pub or something, yeah, with my long-term teenage boyfriend. And we loved Leonard Cohen and Lou Reed. And we did Oh Happy Day by Spiritualized.
Oh, wow.
We kind of sang it together.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was so, I was so nervous. I just kind of hid my face and thought I was going to die because I was so scared. But But I did it, and then I came off stage and people were like, oh, your voice is beautiful. And I was like, oh, because I hated my voice and I was so self-conscious when I was younger.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was great it was absolutely horrifically terrifying, but I'm glad I did it because, you know, the first time is always the worst.
Yeah, and also that song especially, I mean, that's quite challenging to do, but clearly you know, you were connected to that. So
yeah.
Then the question that we always ask on the show is what your first concert was that you saw live, the first band you saw live.
I've got a pretty good answer for this. Mine
really?
Was, I was about 9 years old and I went to see Michael Jackson with my mum at Wembley Stadium doing the Bad Tour.
Yes, that's amazing.
And it was amazing. It was so good.
Oh my gosh.
So, I mean, you know, as a kid, seeing that was like very, made a huge impression.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com. Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts. Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod. And generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already. Thank you again for listening to this week's episode. Here's a little reminder that StubHub is the best place to score the tickets you need whenever you need them. Backed by their 100% fan protect guarantee, StubHub has the seats you want at the price you want to pay. And they're never sold out, so you can score tickets up to the last minute. Head to cosradio.lv/StubHub. That's cosradio.lv/StubHub. And then enjoy the show.
Consequence Podcast Network.